Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's Your Call, we are talking about how the people can restore power to the majority with two guests who study and write extensively about how power works. In her book, No Shortcuts, Jane McAlevey argues that in order for progressive movements to succeed, they need strong unions that put power back in the hands of workers. Jane McAlevey is a longtime organizer in the environmental and labor movements. She is the author of several books, including most recently, No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. Jane McAlevey is currently working on a book about why unions still matter. And Jane joins us in studio. Hi, Jane. Thanks for coming in. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you. And in her book, Democracy in Chains, Nancy McLean writes about how the radical right has fundamentally changed the rules of democratic governance, shifting control from the majority to a wealthy minority. Nancy McLean is professor of history and public policy at Duke University and a scholar of the 20th century United States. She's also author of 5 books, most recently, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. And Nancy is joining us from North Carolina. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's great to be back with you and to be sharing the show with Jane, too.
Well, you two are my dream team when I read both of your books. But before we dive in, I just want to ask you, Nancy, since you're in North Carolina, how are you and how are things there?
Thank you. I appreciate it. They were predicting quite the cataclysm, so we were all relieved that it was not as bad as predicted in the East Coast. And, of course, poorer communities along the East Coast, which is the old plantation belt, have gotten the worst of it. We're coming back now.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. But the death toll still is at 32, which is,
yes,
I didn't
it
think
is.
It would be
yeah,
that high.
It was predicted to be so much worse.
Oh,
so
wow.
I guess that's part of it for those of us who were preparing for it. It seemed, it was such a relief not to have it be as bad as predicted. But yeah, it's frightening. And it speaks directly to our topic today because the people who are promoting climate science misinformation and preventing us from dealing with the things that are making hurricanes worse are also the people that we're talking about who are skewing our politics for a minority of extremely right-wing wealthy donors.
Well, let's dive right into that because you're right. Isaac Stanley Becker at the Washington Post had a good piece called Scientists Warned of Rising Sea Levels in North Carolina. Republican lawmakers shelved their recommendations.
Yes. They were not even, our radicalized GOP Tea Party General Assembly majority would not even let people talk about sea level rise. I mean, that's how crazy it got. So, yeah, for the 30 Republican-controlled states now, including North Carolina and many others, you know, we just live in some kind of alternate universe on many of these questions.
Well, you both write extensively about how power works, and your work is really connected because at the heart of it is that power has been shifted from the majority to an extreme wealthy minority. And if these people were honest with the masses about their ultimate plan, the people, the grassroots, the people on the ground would never go along with it. Jane?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so delighted, Nancy, to be sharing the show with you. I thought Democracy in Chains was just absolutely fantastic. And it made me sort of jump up, not with joy, obviously, but jump up with joy for clarity, because I do think the point you just made, Rose, is dead on. And, of course, Nancy makes it. And, of course, I make it in No Shortcuts, which is they're never honest and transparent with what their actual goals are. And what their actual goals are is extreme rule by the minority. So there's this disjuncture where you have, let's just take the Democratic Party strategy, where people sat around in the 2000s saying, oh, demography is destiny. We'll soon will be a majority people of color country. And everything's going to just work out for us. And what they failed to do was either A, seriously understand how the radical right works, or B, seriously take into account the willingness to totally destroy the country. So, I mean, like, destroy every democratic institution in this country, small d democratic institution. So, the kind of voter suppression that we're seeing in this country, and boy, North Carolina, I mean, Nancy's right in it, right? But like the kind of voter suppression mechanisms that they're using in this country are destroying the Voting Rights Act, decimating unions, obviously. But like literally the voter suppression mechanisms are aimed at making it so we can never manifest the kind of supermajorities that we really actually are. And part of what I look at very carefully in terms of power structure analysis is I'm mostly existing inside the world of trade unions for the last, you know, most of my adult life. And what I see happening to the entire United States right now is what I've experienced inside of the trade union sector my entire life, which is bold lies, sowing doubt, sowing fear, division and hate and voter suppression. Like that's the rule book forever to stop workers from having unions in this country. And so when I read Nancy's book, I'm like, oh yeah, they're just exporting that to the whole country right now.
Nancy, what would you add?
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating point that Jane made, and I think we're in a mutual admiration society about the books, but I was really intrigued by her point in one of her books that the tactics that the national political right is now using are, you know, come from the union avoidance industry, the professionals that corporations hire to divide workers to prevent union drives from succeeding. So I think that's a really, really incisive and significant thing to point out. I guess maybe what I would add, too, is that the stakes of this could not be higher. I mean, we're now facing attempts to change the U.S. Constitution, right, the ultimate rule book of our society. And that is not only by the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, vetted by the Federalist Society, for which Charles Koch provided seed money in the beginning and which Koch continues to fund, but also a longtime Koch ally in the White House, Donald McGahn, the now outgoing White House counsel, was the person assigned to vet all the judicial nominees and to choose Kavanaugh. So it is astonishing that the control that the Koch-led right has had over stocking our judiciary. But what's also frightening and not getting enough attention is that they're actually building towards the first state-convened constitutional convention in our history since the Constitution was ratified. And while most of us are being, you know, distracted by the president's daily tweets and outrages, they have been quietly amassing the authorizations they need from the requisite number of states to call the first constitutional convention ever. And they now have 28 of the 34 states needed. There are 6 Republican-controlled states that could get them to that 34 that have not yet authorized, and they are using the profligate deficits that they ran up with Trump's tax bill in order to secure those authorizations, with the promise of the first item on the agenda of such a convention being a balanced budget amendment. So, you know, this could not be a more serious, strategic, long game to transform our politics that we need to be aware of, but also we have been caught unawares because, as Jane points out in her work, the left has been doing the opposite for years now, right? Playing a very short game, thinking only ahead to the next election cycle or maybe the next presidential election cycle, operating in silos, you know, frightened to use the powers that we have. And so we've got a lot of rethinking and re-strategizing to do on the progressive side if we are going to be able to deal with a challenge and a threat of the scale that we're facing now.
Yeah, and I mean, this is to the point again. Why when I picked up Democracy in Chains, which I actually picked up after I saw Rosa Aguilar last time here, she said, "Have you read that book yet?" I said, "I keep hearing about it," and I literally went home and devoured it. And it was an easy thing for me to devour, and it's, you know, red highlighted all over it. But part of what I say to people, a lot of people say to me, "Are you excited about the fall midterm elections?" And I say no. Then they say to me, "What about the Mueller investigation?" And I say no, because even though both of those things matter, my focus and our entire country's focus has to be, in the words of Nancy, sort of the long game. I talk about the long-term political power structure strategy. We need people focused on the forces behind Trump. Like, Trump is the distractor in chief, but actually the force, I mean, Trump will have an inevitable demise. It's going to happen one way or another, right? But what comes behind him? First of all, Pence. Okay, I'm not jumping up for joy about Mike Pence. He's an absolute lunatic. Second of all, like, the forces behind Trump, the NRA, the Koch brothers, the litany of organizations that as a historian Nancy raises and as a political strategist I look at, and I'm like, who's behind the union busing industry? Well, it's the same people. The Mackinac Center, which comes up in Nancy McLean's book, is literally, the Mackinac Center is literally who has been driving the destruction of trade unions in this country right now. So, you know, when you think about this, the other thing that was really interesting to me is, in Nancy's book, you talk about their obsession, Buchanan's obsession, and the business rights obsession with the term collective versus the individual, which we know is like the culture of the United States. The propaganda is driving the idea of the sort of rugged individual, right? Okay, so what's interesting to me is, on the trade union side, we know that trade unions have been our strongest collectivizing force of the working class. And if you look at, like, I was rereading Tim Snyder's book about tyranny, right, and the lessons about tyranny, and number two is safeguard institutions. If you look at, not to sound too extreme, but if you really look at, as he did in his little, you know, rules for us, the first thing Hitler did when he won in 1933, on May 2nd, 1933, Hitler banned the trade unions. He came in, he seized their office, he seized the property, he jailed the leaders. There's a reason for that, and all the analysis about how fascism rose in Germany. And again, I'm not suggesting we're there yet, but history lessons matter. So there's a reason that Hitler banned the trade unions as one of his first acts, and it was because he understood the working class mattered deeply to his strategy, and he had to divide them, destroy them, etc. So in this country, they're not going to walk in and do the same things they did in 1933 in Germany, but what they are doing is actually destroying the trade unions systematically. And it's not an accident. On September 14th, just last week, there was a new rule issued that they haven't publicized yet. It's not been a publicly made document. We have inside sources for it that they're going to start, like, charging trade unions for not returning phone calls to members. Like, there's a new September 14th rule that's going to prompt a whole bunch of lawsuits internally. And then the last thing I would say about this is it's so germane, the idea of the collective versus the individual, so strong in Nancy's book, so strong in how I think about the work that we need to do going forward, which is to bolster trade unions strategically. But, like, there's been three lawsuits just since 2010 in the U.S. Supreme Court. One was Knox v. SEIU. The next was Harris v. Quinn. The more recent one that folks have heard about is Janus versus AFSCME. And each one of them set up the next attack. So each one, just like the voting rights attacks, each one sets up the next attack. In Janus v. AFSCME, what most people missed is they essentially invited the next lawsuit to come to the Supreme Court with, they hope, Kavanaugh there. And the next one is actually going to ban collective bargaining. It's actually going to say that it's an infringement on First Amendment rights. So I want to hear what the six states are, Nancy, getting back to strategy, by the way. Like, what are the six states where they haven't yet authorized? I think that would be a good thing to know.
Idaho, Kentucky, Montana, Minnesota, South Carolina, and Virginia.
Great. Yeah, all focus on.
Today we are joined by Jane McAlevey, a longtime organizer and author of No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. She's working on a book about why unions still matter. And Nancy McLean is professor of history and public policy at Duke University and a scholar of the 20th century in the U.S., author of many books, including Democracy in Chains. And when I read both of these books, I thought I need to have these women on the show together to talk about how power works. If you have any questions for Jane or Nancy about power, where we are now, how we got here, where we're going, I mean, as Jane said and Nancy said, we're so distracted by the tweets and the latest book about what's going on. Now Stormy's out with the book, so that's going to get probably attention for the next week. But keeping your eye on how power works, what are your questions and comments? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Nancy, when I read your book, I mean, the thing that really stood out to me, and I keep saying this on this show, is that if the extreme right, very wealthy, leading libertarian thinkers were honest about their agenda, the people would never go along with it. And you told the Chronicle of Higher Education that one of the core tenets of your book has not gotten that much engagement from critics, and that is that libertarian thinkers concluded they could never win over the majority to their agenda.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, there has been such a pile on from Koch grantees in academia, you know, in faculty positions, and in Koch-funded organizations about the book. But what's really fascinating is to see what they do. And what they try to do is center their critiques on the early part. And I think, you know, part of that is that they can't accept that one of their founding figures was morally compromised by the Southern segregation context in which he set to work. But also, I think they're very nervous about their own lower-level operatives and the young people that they are recruiting by droves, you know, with very, very generous funding, creating this gravy train to get young people into the pipeline. I think they don't want them to get to the later parts of the book, because the later parts of the book show that even some people who were associated with this enterprise turned against it because they could see how crudely instrumental and autocratic Charles Koch is, and that the strategy, as you say, is being pursued in the self-conscious knowledge that this right, this libertarian right, is a tiny minority. Charles Koch himself said when he was launching this effort in earnest in 1997 with George Mason University as a base camp just across the Potomac from Washington, he said, "Since we are greatly outnumbered, the failure to use our superior technology ensures failure." And by superior technology, what he meant is this weaponized version of a set of ideas that I describe in the book, and using those ideas to systematically undermine collective power, particularly labor unions, particularly public sector labor unions, because they're the strongest and the most progressive in contemporary America, and they're important lobbying forces for the common good, as Jane was suggesting. He's also referring to radical rules changes of all kinds, including the most sophisticated gerrymander we've ever seen in American political history, so that these Republican elected officials are choosing their voters minutely rather than allowing the voters to choose their elected officials, talking about the voter suppression, and all of these, you know, I mean, they go onto pages in North Carolina, the radical rules changes that this Koch-backed right has put through. So it is really quite a stunning thing, but to me the single most important thing to know is that they do understand that they are a minority, and that is why they are blowing smoke into the public's eyes. That is why they promote systematic misinformation like climate science denial, the myth of voter fraud, you know, attacks on critics like Jane Meyer, myself, and others. So I think once we know that, instead of feeling so defensive and in a kind of, you know, fetal crouch from the shock and awe style attacks we've seen on so many fronts, we begin to see where it's coming from, that it's coming from their sense that if they don't make this big power grab, they will lose. And I think that's tremendously important to developing good strategy.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, again, it gets to the question of, look, there's a direct relationship between understanding power structure analysis. Like, how do we understand power? And then how do we make good strategy, right? So my books are mostly about understanding power and its direct relationship to strategy, because I'm a strategist, because I'm an organizer, right? So on this question of the sort of the structure-in-chief, what's so interesting to me is there's a lot that the progressive movement writ large could learn from trade unions and from the really kind of hard contested fights that we are in basically all the time, because that's what the country is right now. So one example is, you know, I wrote a piece right after Trump came in, which, whatever, it was a small piece, didn't get much attention, called, you know, Beware the Distractor in Chief. So in when workers in this country try to form a union, again, there's a laboratory for how to defeat the forces of Trump, and it's called Workers Who Are Still Winning Unionization Elections and Workers Who Are Still Winning Strikes. And we should talk, by the way, about what's happening in Los Angeles before too much time goes on, because there's a very important labor struggle going on in the second largest city in this country right now. But in a labor campaign, the employer strategy, and these guys are hiring people from the Mackinac Center, Koch-funded operations. They're called union avoidance firms. They're professional union-busting operations that I've spent my entire life going up against. And the way we defeat them is, when it comes to the message distraction, is you never repeat the boss, what we call the boss message. And in my view, Trump is the boss in the White House. Like, we're in a national boss fight. In a labor campaign, first thing we coach the workers is the boss will say something totally outrageous and all the workers want to talk about it. And the first thing we say is stop talking about it. Like, don't even repeat the boss message. Stay on your message. Stay on your campaign. Keep asking the employer, we want to have a better quality of life in this workplace. We want to take care of our kids. We want to take care of our patients. What is it that you're offering that can actually change the quality of life in the workplace, right? So we say to people, the most important thing you do is you don't get distracted by what we call the boss message, the employer message. And to me, Steve Bannon, Breitbart News, the Koch brothers, the Mackinac Center, and Trump, essentially, and the forces behind him, have created one big national boss fight in this country. And if people want to learn how to defeat it, they need to look at those of us who continue to defeat it inside of every big workplace campaign. And Los Angeles right now is ground zero. The Koch brothers, the funding, there's a billionaire class funding attempting to decimate and take over the entire public school system in Los Angeles. And the single biggest defenders and most powerful defenders happen to be a terrific teachers union called United Teachers of Los Angeles. They just had a massive strike vote. They're building parent support. And nothing, there is nothing at issue really in that strike but the defense of public education. And when we understand that unions are actually defending key public institutions that we need, which is why the radical right that Nancy writes about hates them so much, we can get a better view of why it's important to step up and defend trade unions in this moment.
According to the LA Times, 81% of Los Angeles teachers cast ballots. Of those, 98% voted to strike.
It's actually
massive.
It's an extraordinary strike
it's
vote.
It's really stunning. And I think we also have to give credit, too, to the teachers in states without collective bargaining.
Absolutely.
Like my own North Carolina, it was actually teachers in the red states, beginning with West Virginia, then Oklahoma, Arizona, North Carolina, et cetera, who have been experiencing this radical right austerity regime and destruction of public education for years now, who said enough is enough. And their rebellion then inspired the unions in, ironically, in places that are, you know, seem more politically congenial to take up the fight. But I think, you know, this is important that it shows, I think also in this crisis that care professionals are really are seeing front up and personal every day the impact of this austerity agenda, the neoliberalism, the radical rules changes. They are very, very credible witnesses to it. So I think we should be doing everything that we can to elevate those voices. And so I'm glad that we're also talking about this strike in Los Angeles, because it is stunning. 98% of 81% of the voters voted to strike.
Yeah,
like,
and
they know
yeah.
This is an all-hands-on-deck emergency for public education in our country, as it is for democracy, and the two are related. We cannot defend public education unless we reclaim our democracy.
Yeah, totally. And by the way, like that's back to my point about strategy, like looking at 100% out strike in West Virginia, looking at what it took in the Los Angeles school district, the second largest school district in the country, larger than some of the states where the incredibly wonderful strikes were happening, just the LA school district, for them to get 81% turnout. I actually think it went up to like 84, but when the final ballots came in, but for them to get 81% turnout is what union organizers, what we call building supermajorities. And it's what we have to do as an electoral strategy in this country, because when you build supermajorities, the progressive voices in this country win. And what the radical right is so good at doing is voter suppression, right? So that teeny minorities show up at the polls. And they use something called, union busters use something called futility. It's literally part of their strategy. It's called futility. I mean, I love analyzing the right-wing strategy inside of union elections. They call it futility. And they want to make it so that people decide not to show up at the polls at all, because they know if people don't show up at the polls in a unionization election or a strike vote, then their side wins. So we can learn from what the teachers union in Los Angeles is doing. It was taken over by a progressive slate several years ago. They're brilliant, and they built a supermajority turnout. And that it wasn't just like they said, come to the polls and vote. They worked that program for 6 months to get to 81% supermajority turnout.
We're going to take a quick break today. We're speaking with Jane McAlevey, author of No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. She's a longtime organizer. And Nancy McLean, author of Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. We're talking about what it will take to take power back from the extreme minority. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
And you're listening to Your Call on your local public radio station, KALW, here in San Francisco. Hi, I'm Laura Wenis. I'm one of the producers of Your Call. I'm here today with Matt Martin, former general manager of KALW, to ask for your support. Morning, Matt.
Good morning. So many people giving their support at 800-525-9917 or at kalw.org. And if you, like me, are just tuned into this conversation, thankful that this resource is here, now is a great time to step up and show your support. As we're in the final days of our campaign, every call or click right now makes a big difference.
That's right. And to show our thanks for your pitching in to help us keep Your Call on the air, at the level of $120, we'd like to send you Democracy in Chains by Nancy McLean, or you could also select to have No Shortcuts by Jane McAlevey, or if you just can't wait to read both of them, for $200, we'd love to send you the both of them. A bundle offer for your support, which is so important to keeping Your Call on the air.
800-525-9917 or KALW.org. We need independent media right now in this country. When you hear what Jane and Nancy are talking about, there's no question about it. And it doesn't get any more independent than Rose Aguilar. And what I mean by that is not simply that she and her team decide what they want to talk about and what they think is most important, and those decisions are made here locally, but that they bring together a conversation like this, where it's not like, hey, what do you think, Nancy, and let her talk. It's a dialogue. It's a strategy session. That's what you make possible when you give your support.
It's these deep conversations, these honest conversations that cut through all of the noise and just get straight to the heart of the matter, that give you the information that you need. We're also a call-in show. We take your emails, we take your calls, we want to hear from you. We want to respond to the questions that you have for these very interesting, informative people who we have on the air for you. Show your support, 800-525-9917 or KALW.org, and thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about how the people can restore power to the majority. We're joined by two women who study and write extensively about how power works. Nancy McLean is professor of history and public policy at Duke University and author of many books, including Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Jane McAlevey is a longtime organizer in the environmental and labor movements. She's also author of several books. Her most recent is No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age, and Jane is working on a book about why unions still matter. Jane, you were talking about the education strikes, and I want to talk with you quickly about hotel strikes. Workers in seven downtown San Francisco hotels voted to authorize a strike recently. According to Biz Journal, 99% of employees from seven Marriott properties approved the strike after negotiations for higher wages, improved health care benefits, and job security stalled. And then here's another piece from the Chicago Reader. Hotel worker strike is now in its second week with no end in sight. The largest hotel worker strike in Chicago history entered its second week with negotiations still underway. Thousands of members of Unite Here Local One, which represents 15,000 hospitality workers, are picketing around the clock at 25 local hotels in Chicago.
Yeah, and Boston voted to go. Essentially, look, this is a very good union. This is a very important point. I mean, unions are complicated institutions, right? But there's some absolutely brilliant unions out there, and the Hotel Workers Union is one of them. So they're already out in Chicago. Marriott, to Nancy's point about, like, she's studying the history of the radical right, and I've sort of been looking at it as it affects the working class inside of unions. And if you looked at Marriott, the strike is around Marriott. If you looked at the behavior patterns of the Marriott Corporation, you would see, in a nutshell, you know, Buchanan from Nancy's book, the Koch brothers, the radical right wrapped up into one. The Marriott is one of the most historically one of the most effective union busting companies in this country. They pull out no stops to break the unions, to break the workers' hopes of having a better life. Why are the workers out there? Because they're struggling mightily to have a better life in this country at a time when income inequality, because of a power inequality, has reached levels that we haven't seen since the 1920s. So when people say to me, what can we be doing? The first thing I say is learn how to support workers on strike. Like the minute you see it. So if the San Francisco workers go, every progressive in the entire Bay Area, in this case, needs to get down to the picket line, support them, demand that the employers settle, bargain fairly with those workers, and support the workers who are going on strike. It's a terrific union. Same with Los Angeles. So strikes matter. I just finished writing a piece called Why Strikes Matter, actually, that'll come out in a journal called Catalyst. And I was analyzing a book that was originally started in 1923. It was written between 23 and 1950 when it first came out by a CIO, by a trade union organizer who was involved in what were called the Little Steel strikes, one of the bloodiest strikes in our country's history. And when people say to me, like, oh, the conditions are so tough now. I always say, you know, people were being shot on picket lines. When we pulled this country out of the kind of income inequality and the conditions that we see today where a handful of powerful players were making the decisions in this country, it took a lot of effort to get us out of a similar period in the 1920s in this country. And it's going to take, hopefully, not people being shot on picket lines, but there's less likelihood of that happening if the majority of progressive people stand up when they see a picket line, swarm around it, get their friends down it, and defend every single worker on them. Because what strikes do is they enable and force workers to reconcile the differences between them and to build supermajorities. In this country, you do not have anything less than a 90% unified workforce in order to strike. That goes back to, like, why I'm obsessed with strategy. In this country, the Democratic Party's been working something called, like, the small margins strategy that worked really well for Hillary, by the way. But anyway, so it's like we have to shift to what's called a supermajority strategy. Strikes and trade unions are our laboratory for how we build really high participation organizations. Our democracy is not going to function if we can't relearn how to build high participation and sustain it. And that's what unions teach us, and that's what strikes teach us.
Nancy, what would you add? Do we still have Nancy? Hi, Nancy. We're connecting with Nancy in North Carolina, and so maybe we are having phone problems because of the storms there. All right, we'll reconnect with Nancy in just a minute. Let's take a caller. Let's go to Dan in Billings, Montana. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. It is a pleasure to get to talk to you. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling from Montana. Beautiful state.
Beautiful state. Lots of wildfires. Really, really beautiful country. So thanks for taking my question. This has been a really great conversation. My question, I guess this is great that you're still on, Jane, is mostly for you. My question is this: what should young people, especially young radicals, be doing right now, right? So there are a lot of us who've come of age under Obama and the financial crisis and had to digest the 2016 presidential election and the last 2 years of this regime, right, and dead-end jobs in the gig economy. And we also grew up mostly seeing labor unions as not necessarily being super powerful or forward. And I think there's just so many of us who want a mentor and a mission to make the world better and, you know, are casting about for what we should be doing. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, Dan.
Oh, Dan, such a great question. And in fact, that the book I'm writing right now is sort of aimed at what I'm calling a post-union America, folks just like you. So one is, I think that you should be trying to form unions, whether it's in Montana or not. What I like to say to people is the gig economy for – there's several things going on here. One is the gig economy – I don't want to – downplay its importance, but we actually overstate its importance right now in the economy. Like, the vast majority of workers in this country still go to work, still have a time clock, are in relationship to each other, and they're not gigged out yet. So, but even if you're in the gig economy, there's plenty of organizing to be done. So that's one. So two is, if you look at, I say to people when they think about the conditions in Amazon warehouses today and the Amazon call centers, which, by the way, you know, it is such a sin to me that Jeff Bezos gets away with owning the Washington Post. He's the biggest billionaire in the world. Literally, he's now the biggest billionaire in the world. He has more money than the Saudi kings combined. He owns Whole Foods. You know, he owns Amazon, and he treats his workers like crap. Mm-hmm. So, I say to people when they say, oh, my God, trying to figure out how to organize the Amazon empire seems impossible. And I say it seemed impossible to the organizers in the early 1930s when they were looking at the auto plants in this country. Like, people couldn't figure out how the hell were we going to form unions in auto plants where workers were locked away, the conditions were terrible, workers were losing fingers, eyes, hands, the safety conditions were a disaster, and it took true grit and strategy and focus. So there's a lot of young folks going into the Democratic Socialists of America right now. That's a good thing to do. Inside of DSA, I hope that people begin to campaign and fight for a strategic focus on why it's so important to focus back on the United, on the workplace of the United States, not just the United States, but we're talking about the U.S. today. So it's so important for young people to refocus on the workplace. And, you know, if you didn't, if the unions seemed like they're a part of the problem for a period of time, one, we need to get deeper in our analysis of unions. Some unions, of course, are part of the problem, just like some priests in the Catholic Church do horrible things. But we don't give up on the institution as a whole. There have always been tremendous unions out there, and it's workers' choice to build a good union, a high-functioning union like we're seeing in the hotel workers' union, like we're seeing in a lot of the teachers' unions. It takes a focus on getting inside, running first, unionizing, and second of all, focusing on the governance mechanisms of your union and making sure that you've built a good union, because that's the choice that workers have to make. Are we going to surrender the decision to people who may not do things that are good, or are we actually going to make sure that our union is led by the voice of smart rank-and-file workers, because then we get tremendously good unions.
Since you brought up the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, Jane, do you think the DSA can reform the Democratic Party from within? Because a lot of people say you're joining a corporate party, and what we need to do is, this is a long-term strategy.
Nancy, you want to take that one?
Go ahead. What do you think?
I think the growth of the DSA and the success of the incredible appeal of the Sanders campaign tells us a lot about the moment that we're in, and that people are really fed up, and that they are feeling like the system is rigged, that they understand there are chronic problems in our democracy, and that is all to the good. But in terms of the reaction to that, I think that it's actually much wider than the Sanders campaign. You know, I've been working with folks in the Center for Popular Democracy, Working Families Party, Demos, Every Voice, Planned Parenthood, Greenpeace. All of these groups are starting to come together around an agenda of unchaining democracy. And the vision is to have a set of must-have democracy reforms that Democrats are held accountable to when they're elected. So I think this is a crucial piece, is, you know, the traditional failed strategy that Jane has described well in her book and others too, is to just assume like the Democrats are going to solve everything and then concentrate on the next electoral cycle. And that's gotten us to the nadir of power that we have now, which is ironic because on issue after issue, there is supermajority support for the things that progressives believe in, right? So, you know, from giving, you know, better support to public education, to cleaning up the environment, to acting on global warming, to stopping discrimination. You know, you could go on and on and on. We have supermajority popular support for those things, but we've lost power. And part of the reason that we've lost power is that the Democratic Party has not been held accountable to address the things that are keeping our democracy from functioning. So including money in politics, including not supporting independent redistricting so that everybody has a reason to be engaged in the political process because they're actually choosing their elected officials.
Oh, did we lose Nancy?
Voter registration. Things like dealing with the radical rules changes that have been going on in the courts. There is a big agenda of must-have democracy reform that the grassroots, labor unions, progressive groups of all kinds have got to start holding Democratic elected officials accountable to, and not just chirping about Republicans all the time.
Yeah, what Nancy said.
Yeah.
Thanks, Nancy.
Yeah, I mean, can you both elaborate on this? Because we just did a show about gerrymandering with Dave Daly, author of Rat Effed, amazing book.
Oh, he's great. I love that book.
And he basically said, okay, in certain races in November, the Democrats have to come out in massive numbers in order to win. They could win but lose again because of gerrymandering. I'm not hearing many politicians talk about this.
It's absolutely true, and it's crucial. I mean, on average, I believe the extra cushion that Democrats need to have is 7 or 8%, right?
More
than the 1% of traditionally. And I know, you know, in places like North Carolina, I mean, and we're a state featured in David Daley's wonderful book, Rat Effed. My legislative district is described by him in that book as a snowball hitting a windshield and melting. That's how crazy the lines are, right? It is absolutely absurd, to the point where a journalist in North Carolina wrote, you know, after they'd done this gerrymander, and it still applies, he said, our General Assembly could legislate that we all have to wear our underwear on the outside of our clothes, and there's nothing we could do about it the way they've drawn the lines. Now, it's not quite true there's nothing we can do about it, but our near-term mission for these crucial 2018 elections, and I agree with Jane that we need a long view, but if we don't also get turnout for these elections, this is it. So it's crucial to get people out. But in North Carolina, the effort at this point is just to break the supermajority, the Republican supermajority in the General Assembly, so that they're not veto-proof, right? So it's a modest agenda for the near term, but an absolutely crucial one, because they are also trying to alter our Constitution. They are continuing their assaults on workers' rights, on women, on the environment, on anti-discrimination. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Addressing the gerrymandering is absolutely crucial. And I think it's also crucial to say that it must be independent, because in my state of North Carolina and other places, Democrats gerrymandered when they were in power, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't want to face voters. You know, they didn't want to work so hard to convert voters that they wouldn't, otherwise have to. So this is an issue all over the place, and it's a way of saying to people who are alienated from the political process, who are disgusted at this point, and saying a plague on all your houses, it's a way to say to them, hey, come on back in. You know, we are going to apply standards that are going to apply across the board. They're going to reinvigorate democracy. They're going to create accountability, restore transparency, end the corruption. And that, I think, is really crucial to changing the public conversation. You know, it can't just be, hey, we're going to kick these guys out, and then we're going to try to do the same thing they did in terms of choosing voters.
Yeah. And, you can see some of the success already because they actually just did a rule change eliminating the role of the superdelegates inside the Democratic Party. And that is something that the Bernie forces writ large, against the large coalition, trade unions, progressives, all the groups that Nancy named, have been working very hard to do. So it's taking a little bit of time. What's always been interesting about this debate in this country is as an organizer, I've spent a lot of time long before the Tea Party was invented as we know it. I understood as a young organizer that the choice we had was to knock out what I called the bad corporate Democrats from within the party. Mm-hmm. So as a trade union organizer, working particularly in the public sector with a lot of what I call mission-driven women in public sector employment, we were often having to get rid of really bad politicians, and they were often mm-hmm. Democrats. So we were doing what the Tea Party did long before the Tea Party. We were looking for where's a safe seat where the Democrats are going to win, and we're going to knock out the corporate Democrat, and we're going to put in a pro-trade union, believes in science, Black Lives Matter. Like, we're going to put in a good person mm-hmm. and knock out a corporate Democrat. So just given the rulemaking as it exists in this country, I think it does matter. Mm-hmm. I also have to get in the idea that we need to be all in, all focused on 2018. The truth is, we also have to be all in for disruption in the economic arena. This is capitalism. Mm-hmm. That's what strikes are, and that's what unions are. Mm. So we mm-hmm. got to do both. We got to be able to, chew gum right. and walk at the same time.
We have a caller who'd like to talk about Democrats. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. I guess maybe I have a little bit different take on this. We've got Democratic control in the state of California for how many years now? And we've got some fairly strong unions, but here we are with a Democratic majority, and we can't even get the Democrats in California they weren't the ones who wanted to go for the Costa-Hawkins repeal or Prop 13 repeal or Medicare for All or some kind of health care system in the state of California. They're corporate Democrats. The trade unions haven't been able to put the kind of pressure on them to get them out. I think that the problem, that's what I see as the problem, both with the unions and with the Democrats. And you don't have an alternative in California. There's no third party in California that you can go to if you're dissatisfied with a corporate Democrat. And I've got one right. I've got two of them where I live, Jerry Hill and Berman. And so there's no way to get this done under the current system. It would take too long to go into some other ideas I have, but I think that, look, the state serves a purpose in a capitalist economic yeah. system, and that your guests know this, and that's the problem.
Mm. Well, Greg, thank you.
I think that's true. I think that's absolutely true, but I also think we shouldn't underestimate the powers that we do have in the near term, and I think, New York is in some ways analogous to California, right, in that at least compared to places like where I live in North Carolina, these red-controlled states, you know, it is kind of a bastion of Democratic power, and yet you saw some of the same behavior from Andrew Cuomo that you're talking about in terms of corporate Democrats. You know, he had this fictive independent Democratic, what they call it, independent
IDC
Democratic
caucus.
An organization that allowed him to collaborate with Republicans in order to undermine unions and administer an austerity program and do all these other things. And that is one of the most significant things about the primaries held last week that hasn't gotten the attention of the governor, you know, the competition in the governor's race, because, you know, there was a celebrity, Cynthia Nixon. But beneath that, five of seven of those essentially collaborators with Republicans were wiped out by primary challenges by progressives. That has put a lot of pressure on Cuomo. He has had to adopt a much more pro-reform, pro-union, pro-women, et cetera, agenda than he would have otherwise. So I quite agree with the caller that there is this problem and is this challenge, but I think, you know, we have to say, okay, so what do we do about that challenge? And I think the thing to do is have a strategy of compelling accountability, including by making Democrats like that feel some pain sometimes with something like a primary challenge. And that does seem to be having effect in a lot of these primary races that we're seeing that are putting those more establishment Democrats on notice that they need to, you know, they need to change it up.
Jane? Yeah. I just think we have to look at the process of what it takes to build the kind of majorities needed to kick the corporate Democrats out. And I couldn't agree more. The getting rid of the IDC. I'm a New Yorker and I'm a Californian, so I'm sort of schizophrenic and I exist in both. And watching the progressive base focus at the level at which we need to focus, which is more local races, and actually decimate Cuomo and the corporate Democrats, IDC, the so-called independent Democrats, in New York last week was, it's not getting nearly enough attention, nor is what's happened in Oklahoma, where teachers decided to run for office and knock out, you know, 16 of 20, whatever it was, like the vast majority of bad folks just got knocked out in Oklahoma by an energized teachers movement coming off the strike there. Again, back to the value of strikes, what they do, they re-give workers and the working class confidence to enter politics and challenge bad Democrats. We're not just needing to challenge bad Republicans. We know that. We need to challenge bad corporate Democrats.
We have only 3 minutes left. Just quick question for you, Jane, from Bill in New Mexico. Sorry, Bill, we can't take your call. We're almost out of time. To what extent did the Democrats abandon unions from the 1970s to the 90s?
Oh, God, it's all over my book. Almost completely. I mean, in the new preface to the second edition of No Shortcuts, you know, I begin by saying the Democratic Party has been absolutely complicit in this. And this is part of why, you know, from Hitler and the Nazis to the Republican right to the Mackinac Center to everyone that Nancy McLean talks about in her book, like I keep saying to people, it's like everyone understands that the working class matters except the Democratic Party, who basically completely abandoned the working class. And we got Trump as a result of it. And, you know, this is why we need to get rid of the corporate Democrats and restore the values of a better Democratic Party on the way to something much better in a future that I, you know, won't be here for. But we need to do it.
Hmm. We have an email from a very concerned citizen. This is good to end on. How can I help? What can I do? This scares me. Please give us action items to reverse this long game. Nancy, what are your thoughts about a minute left?
Yeah, I'm so glad that they said that. When I say, I mean, there is no magic bullet to this thing, right? The strategy is coming from so many different organizations on so many different fronts in such an integrated way that the fact is each individual who is concerned should inventory who they are, what networks they're a part of, do they have a union, do they have a faith congregation, are they part of a community group, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Find a way to get involved that uses your passions, that uses your talents, and as you get involved in that effort, make sure that you're connecting the work to the bigger picture and alerting as many people as you can to how serious the threat is, but also how big the opportunity is to really renew our democracy so that we can finally deal with these chronic problems and go forward to address the challenges and the opportunities of the 21st century as we've been needing to do for so long.
Jane, 1 minute.
I love listening to the historian turn into the organizer. That was great, Nancy. Yes, you should do all the things that Nancy just said. In addition to that, again, I just want to come back to this. Like Rose read off the fact that there may be strikes happening in San Francisco in the hotel sector. If you're in this area, you need to actually figure out how to actively do the same thing. Map your if you're in a congregation. By the way, it's Yom Kippur today. So, you know, people need to think about all the connections they have in their own lives and their own communities and put them to work supporting not just the electoral strategy, but also the strategy to defend, as Tim Snyder said in On Tyranny, to defend and safeguard institutions, safeguard public education, run for local office, run for a school board race, safeguard the unions that are fighting for public education, and think about the electoral arena. Both those things are true.
Jane McAlevey is a longtime organizer and author of many books, including No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. She's working on a book about why unions still matter. Jane, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Your work. Nancy McLean is professor of history and public policy at Duke University and the author of many books, including Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us. And I'm so glad that you and your circle of friends and family are okay in North Carolina.
Thank you, Rose, and it's always good to be with you. I so appreciate your show.
Thank you so much. We'd love to have you back. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.